As physicians, we all live by the patient-centric credo, primum non nocere, or first, do no harm. We all have the best intentions and want to do right by our patients. Unfortunately, a reality is that part of the human condition is to make mistakes. Thankfully, we recognize this flaw and have done our best to put systems in place to try to prevent errors in our daily practice. In our next dialogue, Dr. Maurice A. Thu and Dr. Elliot Mostow tell us about preventing errors in practice.
Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Elliot Mostow. Dr. Mostow is a clinical professor and chairman of the department in Akron, Ohio, and an associate clinical professor at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome, Dr. Mostow.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And what we're going to talk about is something that's of great interest to you because you've talked a lot about this and you've made presentations on it. In the prevention of errors in medical...
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, lately we've been titling this whole topic the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of errors.
None of us is perfect. We all make mistakes, right?
That's true.
How many problems are we really seeing because of mistakes?
Well, it depends on what framework you're going into, to be honest with you. Certainly, you can look at national and international work, and the numbers are in the hundreds, thousands, to even millions, depending on what you look at in terms of patient deaths in terms of medical errors. In our dermatologic practices, and this is really where I like to draw things down to, we tend to be outpatient medicine. We do lots of procedures. We do lots of other things. And I like to say sort of globally, the problem's huge. In our practices, it's surely bigger than we like to think about.
How many people die in the United States because of mistakes?
Well, the numbers that are often quoted by the Institute of Medicine report are 44,000 to 98,000 hospitalized patients die annually, and another million are injured from medical errors. And this was from an Institute of Medicine report that was published in the late 90s. Now, the interesting part about that is that number keeps being quoted. There have been other numbers that make the numbers even bigger. I like to say that whatever that number is, it's too big.
Well, of course, that is a huge number, however. And what of these people, of the nearly 100,000 fatalities, what do they die of usually?
What do they die of? Interesting question. To be honest with you, I can't give you an exact answer on that. I think, in fact, it would be a variety of things, probably related to infections, other complications of surgery and the like.
How about accidents?
Accidents, in terms of accidents...
Falling over, things like that, does that happen very much?
These are big problems around the world. Hospital falls and the like are big issues.
Yeah. I understand that something like 7% of the cases of malpractice are because of people who fall in the hospital.
The hospital realm is no question. Hospital falls, medicine errors, people doing wrong site surgery. They can cause all sorts of issues. And of course, complications related to infection are huge, not only in developing countries, as one might expect, but even in the United States, much greater than one would like to think. And in fact, one of the things that I co-lead a talk I've done at the different meetings with Dr. Steve Helms, and we like to talk about the whole issue of preventing errors, especially related to infection, simply by following sort of checklist-based protocols in terms of getting aseptic and sterile technique before doing things like central lines can dramatically reduce infections.
Well, so what kinds of infections do we tend to face now? What are they causing most of the harm?
In our dermatologic practice, you're saying, or globally?
In hospital patients.
Yeah, hospital patients. They'd be staph infections, pseudomonas infections, the typical things we would see in an infectious realm, but certainly a patient who's getting a central line put in, and this is an area where one can define a specific problem. You can say, well, we're getting infections related to central lines. If we change our procedures, can we reduce those infections? And in fact, the results have been dramatic, significant reductions in infection just by following simple protocols.
So how about surgical site infections? Are we doing that as well as we should? I mean, are we preventing them?
Well, you raise an interesting question in terms of surgical at site infections. Of course, the baseline issue is to figure out what's a reasonable level of infection. Any infection, in fact, is too great because any infection, especially with MRSA, can turn into a disaster. No question, we'll all agree to that. In a hospital setting where there are more invasive procedures, the problems can be quite significant. I think in our dermatologic practices, we have to look and keep track of when we have infections. And if we're finding our numbers are going up or with any infection, was there something that we could have done to prevent that infection?
There was a big fuss made in recent years about hand washing. Was that realistic? Do people really not wash their hands enough? Or do they wash their hands with the wrong things?
Well, the hand-washing issue is fascinating, really, when you think about it, because this is a pretty simple procedure. Your hands carry bacteria. You wash your hands, you decrease the bacteria. In our busy practices, we're in contact with a lot of different people, and we touch different parts of their body. We ideally would like to say that 100% of practitioners wash their hands when they leave the room and when they enter the next room, but there's clear data that isn't so. And in a hospital setting where one might monitor that easily with cameras and the like, if you look at hospital workers, which include medical assistants, nurses, doctors tend to be the greatest offenders. So in our practices these days, it's been quite clear that using alcohol-based hand rubs has been the probably a very significant way of reducing bacteria and cross-contamination between patients. And the reason is simply that it's easy. You can do it. It doesn't get rid of Clostridium difficile spores. It won't get rid of, if you've got fecal matter on your hands, it won't get rid of that. But it'll cut down really MRSA, methicillin-sensitive staph, VRE and the like. It does a great job.
Realistically, though, if you see 50 patients a day, and if you wash your hands 50 times a day, you'd have a terrible contact dermatitis.
Oh, no question.
And you'd carry more organisms.
Well, it's an interesting point. Yeah, that's a great point, and I think we have to balance this. There's interesting data on alcohol-based hand rubs that show that properly used, we think that it's going to dry our hands terribly, but in fact, they will dry your hands out less than washing and drying your hands multiple times.
Yeah. But you see, there's another problem here because, would you know, the methicillin-resistant organisms are found in the community now, not just in the hospital. They are in the hospital, and they are in hospital workers. How do you get rid of all that? And how do you get rid of the carrier state in the first place?
Well, now you're talking big questions. I think the answer is we're not going to get rid of it, right? There's going to be a certain baseline of bacteria, and I'm not one that believes we can eradicate all these bacteria. In fact, I think there's some interesting data that says that we need to make sure that we have a certain number of bacteria in our environment so we have a reasonable immune system response to these things. On the other hand, we certainly don't want to see a patient in room one who has some Staph aureus, not cut that bacteria out and take it to the patient in room two. Now, I don't know about you and your practice, but I don't use a stethoscope much at all anymore. But that's another issue, something we're carrying from one room to another. I often talk about in medical students, they have what I call magic glove syndrome. They put on a glove in one room and all of a sudden they think they have magic hands. They can walk now to the doorknob, to the next room. They can touch anything and they don't realize that they need to take off that glove and leave it where it was.
It's been shown that the doors for toilets are covered in organisms that you really wouldn't want to be in contact with.
Yes. That's right. And I actually wanted to do a study at our local doctor's lounge at the hospital where I would culture the door handle to the doctor's lounge every day, but they wouldn't let me do the study.
The other problem is, what about relatives? Relatives come and see the patients. They carry organisms all over the place, a lot of them. How do you stop that?
You've got some great questions here. In fact, you can't stop it. But what you have to do is keep the levels at a reasonable level and encourage people in proper hygiene. The good news is, fortunately, we're all living and talking to each other. And it certainly, whenever we're in a small meeting or in big meetings or parties, the amount of germ exchange is incredible. And, so we're mostly good.
Some of my colleagues make a point of going in and wiping their hands in front of the patient to show they've just put something on. And by the way, they then don't shake hands with the patient. Now, this may be socially unacceptable, but medically it's a good idea.
Medically,
because you've just
idea.
Been exposed. Where's his hands been? He may have just come out of the toilet for you. Who knows?
Past flu season, I had a close relative who was immunosuppressed. And in fact, I was really quite diligent about not shaking hands. And what I was surprised about this year, because I like shaking hands, I like contact with people, I was surprised at how many people thanked me for not shaking hands. I said, it's flu season, and I gave them, the proverbial fist bump or just waved hello, and people were fine with that.
That's okay. People
that's
are
right.
reasonable, I think, to
yeah,
understand
right.
that. They don't
yeah.
want to get some unpleasant infection if they
yeah,
can avoid
right.
it. How about getting rid of the carrier state? Do you try and do that if you have a patient? How about members of the staff? Anesthesiologists, for example, carry organisms in their nostrils, so they may not be getting infected, but they're carrying it. What do we do? How do we monitor the staff? And incidentally, In some countries, you see people left the hospital wearing their scrubs and they're going outside, then they're coming in. Is that a good idea?
No, it's not a good idea, of course.
In Britain, for example, most people stop wearing ties because apparently the tie carries lots of organisms, though it may look all right.
I think that concept, this was an interesting one in Britain, as I understand it, because I looked into this. I've decided that was a good enough reason to not wear ties as often. this whole idea of even having not wearing white coats, because the best situation is no watches, no rings, keep up to your forearms, you know, without anything to, you know, carry extra bacteria, and then wash your hands a little more often.
Do you think doctors shouldn't wear rings, by the way?
I don't think we shouldn't wear rings, but if depending on what environment you were in, I suppose if I was doing neurosurgery, I might not be wearing a ring. For the kind of surgeries we do, mostly in dermatology, I think we're just fine. I certainly don't think there's any data to show that it really makes a difference. I mean, it depends, I suppose, on how paranoid one wants to get. Of course, there's that old adage, you know, even if you're paranoid, someone still might be following you.
Okay. Do you believe in screening the staff in general just to see if they're carriers of MRSA? Does that make sense?
Not in my
sense?
Office. I mean, I think in certain hospital situations, or if they're getting
it's a very high incidence.
Lip. I mean, I think the issue, and you raise an interesting question, and I alluded to it before, is, you know, what's the baseline? One of the things I've gotten out of doing this talk related to diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of errors is keeping track of what's going on, taking that moment to think about where are there issues in my practice? Am I starting to see things that look like more infections? What could be the root cause? Could it be that one of my staff members has MRSA, and how often am I doing cultures to monitor if they do have a wound infection? Am I finding out if it's MRSA?
What about other kinds of things that are going wrong? Medication errors, for example. Tell us about that. How common is that?
Well, certainly with 6,000 plus medications to pick from, the potential is huge. And it was hoped as we move more from paper to electronic medical records that we would no longer have misspelled medications that the pharmacist couldn't read, or something the pharmacist just couldn't read. But in fact, the problems become different. You can read the prescription, but you could have easily clicked on the wrong one, so it would be spelled correctly. And so, I think there need to be partnerships both with our patients when possible and the pharmacist to say, gee, this just doesn't look right. Does this make sense?
Don't you think also one of the problems is where people use these abbreviations often for Latin and they're using them in a different way? For example, OD can mean every other day or it can mean the right eye.
No, absolutely.
Big difference, right?
Sure.
Should we get rid of all that? Just speak English and forget about the Latin abbreviations?
Well, I think we should. The more explicit we can be, the better off we are. I mean, there's no question about it. But
because there have been some horrible mistakes made in the past.
Well, a lot of hospitals won't allow you to use BID or QD or anything like that anymore. At least in the States, they're mandating that they go to, you write, 2 times per day, twice per day, write these words out so there's no ambiguity. And it's not a crazy idea.
When you're talking about controlling the system to try and prevent the error, give me some suggestions about that. How do you do that?
Well, controlling the system to prevent errors. So I suppose what you're asking is the idea of what can we do in our particular offices to try to avoid problems.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. I'm very good when a patient comes in and I've done a biopsy and they have a melanoma. I tell them, you know, I give the same counseling to every single patient. Well, of course, I'm sure if I taped myself, I wouldn't be giving the same counseling to every patient. Maybe I'm in a little more of a hurry one day. Maybe I didn't have enough coffee. I'm not, you know, who knows? So I felt that the information I wanted to give in an ideal sense, I wanted it to be right. And so I developed a checklist educational form where I go through on every single melanoma diagnosis and I run through the whole thing. You know, I found there were simple things. The patient might distract me and I'd forget to tell them, gee, do you have any first-degree relatives? If you do, they now have a statistically increased risk of melanoma and I'm going to recommend that they get treated. I'm going to tell you whether you need x-rays or not. I'm going to hit all these little points along the way. I'll discuss Breslow depth. I'll discuss all the factors of their path report. I'll review it. And once I've reviewed it and checked off these boxes and filled in some boxes, I make a copy of it, I hand it to the patient, I send one to their primary care doctor, and I really feel like it's been, well, I can sleep easy. I've done the same exact form with, you know, making it better here and there in increments for every new melanoma diagnosis for the last 6 or 8 years.
Because certainly if you fly with anyone, there's a cockpit drill that they follow, and they always follow it, because otherwise someday they'd forget something.
Well, that's exactly it. And in fact, we, Dr. Helms and I, when we give the talk we've given quite often, we talk about this whole question of where some of the systematic approach came to medicine. And it came from borrowing from what's called crew resource management from the airline industry. You know, plane crashing, that's pretty lousy. No one likes that. You know, I like to say people are afraid of flying. I say, well, you're not afraid of flying. You're afraid of crashing. And the crashing, I understand. The planes crash, and they found that simply by doing simple things. I mean, these are all good pilots. We're all good physicians, well-intentioned people. No one wants to make errors, but there are simple things we can do to make things better. And following a checklist doesn't make it cookbook medicine. It just helps us practice a little more consistently and can be done in the right way. We often quote works from Atul Gawande, who wrote a book called The Checklist Manifesto. Fascinating, beautifully written book. One of the points I like about checklists is that he says, well, when you make a checklist, it's always going to be bad the first time. And what he's alluding to is a good checklist should be an iterative process. You should say, well, that was pretty good. What can I do to make it better? Let's move the words around. Let's change the check boxes. Let's make this an alive document till we get it to a point where it really feels right, it works for us. Because if it doesn't work, frankly, we're not going to use it.
Apparently one of the problems in hospitals is when one group takes over from another group. So if someone's been working during the day and then someone comes working in the evening, how do we get around? What are they supposed to do? Is that done right? Do we make mistakes on that?
Well, I think these issues, these handoff issues as they're called, are significant. Fortunately for most of us, that's not as big a problem. But depending on what kind of group we're in or who we share call with, I think so many things come down to communication, really. It's the whole concept of working with a team and how one does this. And so certainly the concept of checklists, communication, and a team approach would be three simple things to think about. If you didn't want to dig any deeper, you'd say, well, okay, maybe I can adopt some checklists. Maybe I'm not communicating information quite well enough. And that could be to the person who's taking over a call for me. It could be to the caregiver for that patient. You may have all sorts of grand plans for how that patient's going to use their retinoid or their steroid cream. But in fact, they may not hear you, or they may not be able to do it. But
you ask the patient, what did the doctor say? Did he tell you that? No, he didn't. Did he do something? No, he didn't. Even if that's why it's a good idea to write it down or have someone else write it down.
Well, in the police world, of course, people are talking about having body cameras so that they can document what was actually done. And I've seen some literature to talk about this in the patient care arena, taping what was said. I don't know if you ever had a patient who asked if they could tape the conversation with
yes,
you.
Yes, I always say no.
I have said yes, and I've said yes, but you know, I usually take a breath and I say, okay, let's go. And then, of course, I'm on at that point, right? It's a show, and it's a show where you want to be as accurate as you can.
Other times, we make mistakes because we're wrong. We missed something. How do we get around that? Well, how do we protect ourselves and protect the patients better by not making these kinds of cognitive errors?
Being wrong can happen a lot of different ways, of course. It could be something as simple as we put the wrong label on the wrong bottle, or we didn't get the specimen in the bottle. Or if we hit the cognitive error issue, which, you know, that's the one we perhaps least like to talk about or think about, we don't want to get the wrong diagnosis. So the beginning part is recognizing that these are big problems, and we're not always right. And so humility, I suppose, is the biggest part of it, taking that deep breath that say, I'm right most of the time, but maybe not all the time. And I like to, when I give these talks, sort of think about the whole idea. I ask how many people, you know, have missed a diagnosis of scabies. Well, in a group of dermatologists, everyone has. And while I tell the residents everyone with itching is presumed to have scabies, you know, until proven otherwise, but the truth is that's not really the case. I mean, it might be their hives and they have no other signs to start with.
But it's interesting, though, when I first was in dermatology, one of the best-known dermatologists of the last century was there. And I was working in his office, and the patient had flown in his private plane. And he was there, and this great dermatologist said, I haven't the slightest idea what's wrong with you. I don't believe this. This man has written all these books. He doesn't know. He had the self-confidence to say, I don't know.
That's a beautiful statement you made, Dr. Thieu. And I think some of this is a piece of being comfortable in our skin, having humility. And of course, I don't know is a really nice way of starting to say, but I'm not going to give up till we try to make you feel better. I think there's a lot to be said for that. When I was a resident, Charles Ellis used to talk to us about a lot of things related to patient care and making sure we sat down in front of the patients, because their perception of our time with them was we weren't in such a hurry, and taking that moment to sort of think about it, even when you're sure, you know, they're just going to talk about their psoriasis or their wart on their hand. Sometimes it's important, especially with elderly patients.
Oh, yes. As they say, no matter how sure you are that you're right, remember you may be wrong.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
It's true. Exactly it gets to us. And in a kind of an authority position, as many of us are, it's very difficult to do that, particularly if we are insecure in that role. Yes, and that's the point. We're doing what's best for the patient. And what is better in medicine than that?
Yeah, nothing better.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the most important parts of trying to prevent errors is being able to admit that you may not know the answer right away, instead of trying to fit the diagnosis into a box that you may be more comfortable with. We as physicians hate to think that we may have the diagnosis wrong or that we may not know the answer, but this happens to everyone, and this is why we should be comfortable with asking for help if needed. In a study published by Dr. Mostow and his colleagues, they looked at the treatment of various venous ulcers and products used to treat them. The objective was to develop a tool that would compare treatment options based on clinical parameters so that physicians could use this platform to make informed decisions about wound care for better outcomes. This is a great example thinking of potential complications and potential errors and trying to come up with a system to prevent such errors. A common technique that is used in preventing errors is the use of checklists. As Dr. Mostow pointed out, we all think that we say the same thing to patients when giving information, but in reality, there are always other factors like time and how much coffee you may have had that day. In a study by Kugler and Mostow, a checklist for melanoma patient triage was developed to help improve efficiency in outpatient practice, but also to decrease the reliance on memory to improve patient outcomes. In the past, there had been a lot of errors based on handwritten scripts and the inability for the pharmacist to read them. A study done in 2011 looked at the errors associated with outpatient prescribing systems and compared the data to that of handwritten scripts. They found that 1 in 10 computer-generated prescriptions in their sample contained an error, which was comparable to the handwritten scripts. Although they did mention there were less errors with computer-based systems with more advanced functionality or scripts being written by a physician who had more computer training. Despite making advances to try to prevent errors, we should be aware that they still can occur, only in different ways. It's not all errors, though. We have to give ourselves some credit. Another interesting example is Mohs surgery, which has very low error rates when it comes to tumor recurrence, which is why a lot of patients opt to get that procedure. A recent study by Zabi and Linsky et al. Looked at possible errors in recurrence with Mohs surgery in non-melanoma skin cancer. Their conclusion was that out of 3,169 non-melanoma skin cancers treated, only 22 recurred. They analyzed the recurrences and determined that they were usually linked to errors on histological interpretations or tumor mapping, but that recurrences overall are extremely rare. Overall, Dr. Mostow emphasized cognizance, vigilance, checklists, teamwork, and most of all, humility to help reduce potential errors.